Alabama, in 1850, out of 176,657 persons, 5 to 20 years of age, reported 62,728 pupils, mostly in private academies and pay schools, which meant that the bulk of the white poor had no schools. The established public schools were without a state board, and in 1854 spent only $2.50 a year on each enrolled pupil. The public school system of Alabama was established by the state constitution of 1867 and organized in the following year. It was in continual financial difficulty owing to the bitter opposition of the whites. Irregularities and defalcations in the educational department were charged, and finally, owing to the lack of funds and non-payment of taxes, as well as other conditions, the schools closed in 1873 as the result of the triumph of reaction. But the demand for education was now strong, and the effect of the Northern opinion too great, so that the new constitution made by the Democrats in 1875 kept something of the system, but abolished the Board of Education and sought, as far as possible, to return to the antebellum status. Separate schools for the races were ordered. The administrative expenses were reduced. No money was to be paid to any denominational school or private school. And the constitutional provision of one-fifth of the state revenue for school use was abolished. The United States Commissioner of Education gave a disapproving account of these changes and said it was exchanging a certainty for an uncertainty. This was, in fact, a restoration of education to local reactionary control and cutting off all higher training of Negroes from public help. Alabama felt the result of this narrow policy for many years. The Freedmen's Bureau schools in the state reached only a small portion of the Negroes, and there were a few missionary schools. It is likely that for 5 years there were not more than 200 Northern teachers in the state, and the majority of the white people were hostile toward the education of the Negro. In Florida, a school at Fernandina was established in 1862 by the Reverend Dr. Barrows, who was superintendent, with a half-dozen white Northern teachers. In Jacksonville, the Old Fellows Hall was seized by the United States Provost General and turned over to Dr. Barrows for a school building. Here a school was opened both for Negroes and for whites. When the white children remonstrated against attending school with black children, Mrs. Hawks, the lady principal, said, "Very well. The colored children will be educated even if you will not." It is reported that this type of argument proved effective, and the two races got along harmoniously in school for a time. Several disturbing factors prevented this experiment in democracy from continuing. First, the schools were built upon military force and outside workers rather than the community itself. And secondly, public education was new to Florida and came at a time when it could least afford to have it from the point of view of finances and personnel. Schools were closed in 1864, but education continued in federal military camps. Negro schools began again under the Freedmen's Bureau in 1865, helped by missionary societies, including two colored groups, the AME Church and the African Colonization Society of New York. The Constitution of 1865 under Johnson's Reconstruction established a uniform system of education without specific provisions. There were 30 schools at the close of 1865. The Committee on Negroes recommended immediate education for Negroes, but the legislature of 1866 compromised by establishing a state system of Negro schools under which Negroes were to pay for their own schools. E.B. Duncan eventually became superintendent of both the state and the Freedmen's Bureau schools. This system of schools was based on the plan of making the poor pay for their own education. The schools for freedmen were to be supported by a tax of $1 upon all male persons of color between 1 and 55, and a tuition fee to be collected from each pupil, and the fee for a teacher's certificate, $5, was also to go to the school fund for freedmen. The superintendent was to establish schools for the freedmen when the number of children of persons of color in any county or counties should warrant it, provided the funds provided for shall be sufficient to meet the expense thereof. The freedmen themselves erected schoolhouses and provided further school funds. Some good schools were established under the superintendency of the Reverend E.B. Duncan, an able and conscientious man who worked hard to establish colored schools in every county. At that time, railroad facilities were very poor, and I have known him to walk from county to county in South Florida to establish colored schools. Gradually, the Bureau schools were absorbed into the state system. Although the Bureau was the paramount authority during the period of military rule, 1866 to 1868. Under Negro suffrage came the law of 1869, and all of Florida's educational historians grant that this was the real beginning of a public school system in this state. Near the end of the Radical Republican administration, conditions in education among Negroes of Florida were improved. The field of primary education was virgin. 71,000 inhabitants over 10 years of age were illiterate. 18,000 of them were white. By the end of 1870, 333 schools were open, with 14,000 pupils in attendance, one-third of whom were Negroes. Probably the most outstanding character in the early life of the Florida public school system was a Negro, Jonathan C. Gibbs, whose colorful and efficient career has been noted in Chapter 12. After acting as Secretary of State for 3 years, he was appointed late in 1872 Superintendent of Public Instruction, an office which he held until his death in 1874. It was then a post of considerable difficulty, as the first enthusiasm for a new school system had subsided, and political complications and embarrassment about school funds had come in to hinder progress. But by his energy and enthusiasm in the cause, he so far succeeded that, in the month of August 1873, he had the pride and pleasure of saying before the National Educational Association, "The census of 1860, antebellum, shows that Florida had in her schools 4,486 pupils at an expense of $75,412. Today, Florida has 18,000 pupils in school at an expense of $101,820, fully four times as many pupils at an increase of only 33% expense." In 1876, when the Republicans were driven from power, 676 public schools had been established, with 28,444 pupils, black and white, costing $158,846.36. In North Carolina, Negroes early pushed toward public education. There had been private schools for free Negroes before the war, and they had the example of John Chavis, who studied at Princeton and at what is now Washington and Lee University. Among his white pupils were a United States senator, a governor of the state, and the sons of a chief justice. All accounts agreed that John Chavis was a gentleman. When the law stopped him from teaching white students, he taught a school for free Negroes in Raleigh. In 1867, it was reported that many instances had come to notice where the teachers of a self-supporting Negro school had been sustained until the last cent the freedmen could command was exhausted, and where these last had even drawn on their credit in the coming crop to pay the bills necessary to keep up the school. The most severe critics of Reconstruction must admit that the Convention of 1868 and the Legislature of 1868-1869 set up a fine school system for North Carolina so far as it could. The poverty of the state made the realization of this system immediately an impossibility, but no one can place at their door the laxity and graft of the administrative officers which afterwards characterized the Department of Public Instruction. Their work was to provide a system of public schools for the state of North Carolina, and this they did. The only error with which one may charge them is that they did not set up a system calling for separate schools for Negro and white children, and many people there are who would not class this as an error. Article 9 of the new Constitution, the section dealing with education, made provision for a general system of public schools with tuition free to all persons between the ages of 6 and 21. The counties were to be divided into school districts in which at least one school must exist and run for a minimum term of 4 months. The entire state system was to be governed by a board of education composed of the governor of the state, the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, the treasurer, the superintendent of public works, the auditor, the superintendent of public instruction, and the attorney general. The money to support this system was to come from appropriations from the state treasury, from county taxation, certain fines from the courts, and certain other funds, such as the pre-war literary fund. The school laws were more thoroughly set forth than at any other time in the history of the state. S.S. Ashley, a northern white man who favored mixed schools, was selected superintendent. The new superintendent of public instruction made his first report of the status of education in North Carolina in November 1868. The new school laws had just been passed, and sufficient time had not elapsed for any considerable amount of constructive work to be accomplished. The act authorizing the organization of a system of schools was not passed until April 1869. $100,000 was appropriated, chiefly to come from the poll tax. This report showed that there was a total of 330,581 children between the ages of 6 and 21 in the state. Of this number, 223,815 were white, and 106,766 were Negroes. There were 1,906 schoolhouses or buildings being used for school purposes, of which 178 could be definitely classed as good, and 685 were just as definitely to be thought of as bad. The remainder of the buildings were probably neither very good nor particularly bad. On the assumption that the legislature would appropriate the $100,000 called for in the school law, Superintendent Ashley apportioned this sum among the counties. The capitation tax was supposed to supplement this so that the total from the state to the counties was reckoned at $165,209.50, or 50 cents per census child. This was only an apportionment, as the first money out of the state treasury, which actually went for the support of public education, was not yet distributed. Ashley's second report, issued in the autumn of 1869, gives one an idea of the general situation, and is especially helpful in the matter of Negro education, as it contains the report of the Reverend John Wesley Hood, the Negro who had been appointed as the Assistant Superintendent of Public Instruction in charge of the Negro schools. J.W. Hood, afterward bishop in the AME Zion Church, had been given his position by the Board of Education, but it appears that no legal provision had been made for this office. In calling attention to this report, Ashley simply states that he had been secured as an agent of the Board of Education and as Assistant Superintendent of Public Instruction. Hood had visited every section of the state in compiling his report, and Ashley asked that attention be given to it, as it represents a more intelligent and complete view of the work of education among the colored population of this state than has yet been given. Hood reported that there were 257 Negro schools, with an enrollment of 15,647, chiefly carried on by churches and missionary societies. Ashley estimated 25,000 colored pupils in all, but the financial support of the public schools was bad. It improved, however, by 1872. That year, $412,070 was appropriated, and a property tax helped to raise the funds, just as success seemed in sight. The Democratic Party in North Carolina entered upon its historic policy of white control. The results of the return of the whites to power were soon shown. In 1870, the salary of the superintendent of public instruction was reduced from $2,400 to $1,500, and his appropriations for travel and clerks cut off. The state lost the services of both Ashley and Hood. From yet another quarter was Negro education to receive a blow in the same year. The legal life of the Freedmen's Bureau had expired before this time, but the agents had remained in the field, winding up its affairs. The last of the reports dealing with the educational work at the Bureau is dated July 1870. The very fact that it was generally disliked by the Southern whites is testimony in favor of its effectiveness. And though it did not antagonize the whites on the question of educating the Negro, it stood behind the schools for these same Negroes until such time as they had become pretty well established. Without the support of the Bureau, it is doubtful if any of these schools for Negroes would have existed very long. Reasons of local hostility and financial stringency make this seem probable. A professor of the faculty of the University of North Carolina, Alexander MacGyver, was appointed by the new governor to fill out the unexpired term of Ashley. MacGyver served in this position until January 1, 1875, when he was succeeded by Stephen D. Poole. Poole promptly stole the money of the Peabody Fund entrusted to his care, proving that theft in North Carolina was not confined to Negroes and carpetbaggers. He was removed from office the following year. In 1872, there were 119,083 white pupils and 55,000 colored pupils in school. For a long time, there was continual fear of mixed schools, but an amendment to the Constitution finally eliminated this. In Virginia, the Constitutional Convention of 1867 to 1868 had 25 Negroes, and they and some of the whites were eager to educate the children. The attempt to establish a public school system was vigorously opposed by the reactionaries, but with the backing of the Negroes, the Constitution provided for a uniform system of public schools to be established not later than 1876. This was adopted by the voters in 1869, and W. H. Ruffner became superintendent of public instruction in 1871. The Constitution did not provide for separate schools, but the laws under it did, and the support of the schools was to be obtained from a corporation tax of $1 and a small property tax. The first schools were opened in 1870, and by the end of the year, there were 2,900 schools, with 130,000 pupils and 3,000 teachers. Of these, 706 were Negro schools, with 38,554 pupils. The Negroes were eager for the schools, but the whites were largely indifferent. There was a scarcity of Negro teachers, and many white teachers were used. In Arkansas, there was a so-called school system before the war, but the governor in 1860 called it radically defective and noted only 25 common schools organized and kept up in the whole state from the common school funds. The beginnings of popular education in Arkansas were under the Reconstruction government in 1868. Negroes themselves, after 1865, established the first free schools in Arkansas. This they did at Little Rock, where after paying tuition for a short time, they formed themselves into an educational association, paid by subscription the salaries of teachers, and made the schools free. In July 1865, General Sprague appointed William M. Colby, General Superintendent of Refugees and Freedmen, to cooperate with the state authorities and, if possible, work out a system of education for those classes. Little progress had been made in Negro education under the Lecce system, and Colby had little to build on. Many Arkansas whites did not approve education under the Bureau because they feared it encouraged social equality. Under the Freedmen's Bureau, Negroes built schoolhouses and sometimes furnished as much as 33% of the cost of instruction. The civil government did little toward the encouragement of Negro education. As has been stated earlier, little free school education was furnished for anyone. The legislature of Arkansas on July 2, 1867, provided for a rather pretentious public school system, but all benefits were limited to whites. This was in direct contradiction to the ordinance passed at the Constitutional Convention in 1864. The Constitution of 1868 provided for the maintenance of a system of free public schools for the gratuitous instruction of all persons in the state between the ages of 5 and 20 years. On July 23, 1868, Governor Clayton approved the law under which education was to be carried on. A state board of education had been begun under the Lecce system and continued under the Freedmen's Bureau, but this was the first time the civil government had made any provisions for it. The expense of public school education was to be taken care of by taxation. The masses, black and white, were unprepared for this. Competent teachers were scarce, and school officials were often indifferent. This made the situation very trying. Nevertheless, the work of organization was begun August 1, 1868, with Thomas Smith as state superintendent. The Freedmen's Bureau turned over to school authorities all schools under its control and entered heartily into the development of Negro schools under the new order. In March 1869, a few schools were reported organized. On June 15, 1869, the Daily Republican claimed that there were, in successful operation, nearly, if not quite, 300 schools. The school funds were reduced somewhat in the fall of 1869 because of tax collectors squandering the proceeds. As a result, many school terms were cut and others were closed completely, but some continued. Teachers were, as a rule, inefficient. White teachers in Negro schools were held in contempt. The textbooks were usually fixed by the school board, and occasionally the Democratic press demanded that only books of Southern production be used. J.C. Corden, a Negro graduate of Oberlin, was state superintendent of education from January 16, 1873 to October 30, 1874. Under the Democratic administration, the schools were closed during the years of 1874 and 1875, and the attendance in 1876 was only 8% of the school population. But from that time onward, it gradually increased from year to year. The year 1870 remained the high water mark in school attendance for a period of at least 20 years. In Texas, as a result of the work of the Freedmen's Bureau, the educational work, which was under the charge of Lieutenant E. M. Wheelock, advanced to such an extent that by the end of January 1865, there were in operation 26 day and night schools, with an enrollment of about 1,600 pupils. These schools were supported partly by volunteer contributions, partly by a small tuition fee. The number of pupils enrolled in the schools September 1, 1866, was over 4,500, with 43 teachers. When the State Republican Party was organized, they advocated free common schools and free homesteads out of the public lands, open to all without distinction of color or race. During the convention of 1868-1869, the Committee on Education reported that there were provisions for increasing the existing permanent school fund by adding to it all money to be received from the sale of the public domain, and for applying all the available fund to the education of all children within the scholastic age, from 6 to 18 years, without distinction of race or color. The public school system in Texas was at first in a large measure a failure because of popular hostility to the admission of Negroes to the public schools, coupled with inefficient management by counties. In the convention which reconstructed Louisiana in 1864, the Banks system of schools was discussed, and there was a motion to declare it unconstitutional, but it was finally approved by a vote of 72-9. There was, however, a great diversity of opinion as to the ways and means of providing for the system. It was decided at first to establish schools for whites, supported by the white taxation, and schools for Negroes, to be supported by black taxation. It was argued that unless this measure was adopted, whites and blacks might be compelled to attend the same schools. The friends of the freedman feared that he would suffer by separate taxation. The mover of the previous resolution, Terry, moved some 3 weeks later that there should be no separate taxation of the races, and that the legislature should provide for the education of all children between the ages of 6 and 18 by the maintenance, by taxation, or otherwise, of free public schools. This provision, being adopted by a vote of 53-27, was incorporated into the Constitution. By the Constitution of 1868, all children were admitted to the public schools, regardless of color. The law thus provided for compulsory mixed schools, a condition which prevailed until 1877. As a matter of fact, there were not a great many cases where colored children were pupils in white schools, so that the mixed schools were not universally prevalent. The children of Governor Pinchback, for example, were escorted to a white school by a policeman, but often run off by white hoodlums after the policeman had disappeared. The Freedmen's Bureau was the salvation of Negro education in Kentucky. By the middle of 1866, 35 Negro schools had been established, with 58 teachers. The number increased to 139 in 1869. In 1866, there were 58 teachers with an enrollment of 4,122 pupils. An average attendance of 3,215 was maintained. In 1869, the number of teachers had reached 1,080, and the pupils 18,891. Most of the teachers were Negroes, with a few whites from the North. The revenue for these schools was obtained from state taxes levied on Negroes, private donations, and sometimes tuition fees. By a law passed in 1866, all Negro taxes, including a poll tax, were to be divided equally between Negro schools and Negro paupers. In 1867, an additional poll tax of $2 was levied on Negroes, but it was soon repealed in 1871 after considerable Negro opposition. In 1873, Negroes also threatened to appeal to the state and federal courts to obtain by legal process equal school advantages. Not until the advent of Sack F. Smith, as state superintendent of education in 1867, did public school education in Kentucky take on new growth. In the 1869 elections, the people voted an increase in school taxes to 20 mills on the dollar. By 1871, the school receipts had increased from less than $400,000 in 1869 to almost $1 million. The number of districts from 4,477 to 5,177. The number of pupils from 376,000 to 405,000. In the District of Columbia, Negroes began their self-supported schools in 1807. Led by three former slaves, a great educational movement began. Other schools followed during the early 19th century, and finally, efforts to start a free school system for Negroes in the district were made in 1856. The project was overwhelmingly defeated by white voters at the polls. In 1862, May 21st, Congress passed an act providing that 10% of the taxes collected from colored people be appropriated to establish public schools for Negroes. Three trustees for the Negro schools in Washington and Georgetown were appointed by the Secretary of the Interior, but even the meager funds thus provided were only in part turned over to the Negroes. For 2 years, only $736 had been credited to the Colored School Fund, and the first public school for Negroes was not opened until March 1864. In 1864, another act became the fundamental school law for the whole district. This provided that the authorities should set apart every year from all its receipts for educational purposes such proportionate part thereof as the number of colored children between the ages of 6 to 17 years in the respective cities bear to the whole number thereof. For the purpose of establishing and sustaining public schools in said cities for the education of colored children. In 1866, Congress appropriated $10,000 to purchase school sites and erect buildings, and after these laws, the Negroes began to receive a just proportion of the school funds. It was not until the year 1867 that these trustees obtained sufficient funds to undertake the establishment of any considerable number of schools. Previous to that time, for about 3 years, from 60 to 80 colored schools had been maintained at a large expense by various benevolent associations in the northern states. There were 26 private schools in 1864, and between 1860 to 1864, $135,000 was contributed by philanthropists for the work. After this, for several years, the white and colored school systems were practically separate, each with their own superintendent. Finally, about 1890, One general superintendent with white and colored assistants under him combined the two school systems. In Delaware, early attempts at the education of the colored youth were made by the Negroes themselves, and it was not until 1875 that schools for Negroes had any recognition by the state. By personal taxes, tuition fees, and voluntary contributions, these people were able to keep up the work of education until the General Assembly of the state assumed the responsibility in 1881. Since that date, the work of educating Negroes has been a matter of public concern, with much discrimination against the colored schools. In the other border states, the development of the Negro schools was somewhat different. Missouri and West Virginia established free schools about the same time that the other states did, and maybe provisions for Negroes. Tennessee was slower, while Maryland, like Delaware, refused to provide for colored children at first, and for a long time granted them only the taxes raised among themselves. Not until 1880 were the colored children generally in border states put on a legal footing with other children in education. It will be noted that in nearly all the southern states, there were continual and well-proven charges of peculation and misuse of public school funds. This was not a part of the general charge of stealing and graft, but was the fault of local county officials. In most cases, the leading white landholders who took no part in the administration of the state nevertheless kept their hands upon local taxation and assessments, and were determined that the impoverished property holder should not be taxed for Negro education. By various methods, direct and indirect, they thus continually diverted the school funds, and this class of white people were primarily the ones responsible for such dishonesty as there was in the administration of local school funds. On the other hand, there were Negro and poor white officials, here and there, who were guilty of waste and theft. During and after Reconstruction, diversion of school funds was common. In North Carolina, $136,076 was collected for education in 1870, but the Department of Education received only $38,931. In Louisiana, $1 million worth of bonds for the school fund were used to pay the expenses for the legislature in 1872. In Texas, a large part of the income and public lands which belonged to the education fund was lost. In 1870, the school funds in Georgia were partially used for other purposes, and in 1874, Alabama school funds were diverted. In Tennessee, from 1866 to 1869, only 47% of the school taxes were spent on schools. In nearly every state, the question of mixed and separate schools was a matter of much debate and strong feeling. There was no doubt that the Negroes in general wanted mixed schools. They wanted the advantages of contact with white children, and they wanted to have this evidence and proof of their equality. In addition to this, they were strengthened in their stand by white Northern leaders, who pointed out the practical difficulty of two separate systems of schools, which must, to an extent, duplicate effort and would certainly greatly increase cost. In many of the states, the matter was left in abeyance, and in some states, like Louisiana, mixed schools were established. This raised a fury of opposition among the whites, but for reasons of economy and democracy, it was obviously the best policy. The propaganda of race hatred made it eventually impossible, and the separate school systems so increased the cost of public education in the South that they resulted in the retardation of the whole system and eventually in making the Negro child bear the burden of the increased cost. So that even to this day, throughout the South, the Negro child has from one-half to one-tenth as much spent on his education as the white child. And even then, the white child does not receive sufficient funds for a thorough elementary education. Separation by race was prohibited in the constitutions of South Carolina and Louisiana. In Atlanta, the Board of Education wanted mixed schools, but allowed separate schools when they were desired. The trustees of the Peabody Fund caused the dropping of a clause prohibiting separate schools in the original draft of the Federal Civil Rights Bill of 1875. One Southern congressman's speech represents the strength of this fear. "Woe be unto the political party which shall declare to the toiling yeomen the honest laboring poor of this country, your children are no better than a Negro's. If you think so, you shall not practice on that opinion. We are the rulers. You are the servants. We know what is best for you and your children. We, the millionaires, we who are paid out of your pockets, will take your money and will send our children to select high schools, to foreign lands where no Negroes are. But you who are too poor to pay, shall send your ragged, hungry urchins to the common schools on such terms as we dictate, or keep them away to stray among the treacherous quicksands and shoals of life, to wander on the streets and learn to syllable the alphabet of vice and crime, or stay at home and, like blind Samson, in mental darkness, tramp barefoot the treadmill of unceasing toil. In the Reconstruction constitutions, state taxation for schools was a new feature, unknown in the previous school laws of Alabama, Florida, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, and South Carolina. The principle of direct taxation was undoubtedly the most important contribution of the Reconstruction regime to the public school movement in the South. It was perpetuated in all the revisions of these constitutions after 1876, except in Alabama. The victory of Home Rule in 1876 was followed by a period of hostility, or at least indifference to public education. In 1879 in Virginia, $1 million belonging to the school fund had been used for other purposes. In Georgia, the legislature of 1876 destroyed $350,000 worth of bonds belonging to the school fund. Tennessee, in 1869, abolished the general tax for school purposes and the administrative system. The Alabama Constitution of 1875, instead of allocating one-fifth of the state revenue to education, which was the provision in the Constitution of 1868, substituted direct appropriation. In Arkansas, the income from land sales belonging to the school fund was used for other purposes. There were similar reductions of school revenue in Louisiana. In Texas, a voluntary county system was substituted for the state system in 1875 and 1876. The public school system of the South was helped by the gifts of the Peabody Fund in 1867 and 1869. On account of the influences mentioned, it became common throughout the South for all parties to pledge themselves to the cause of public schools. Yet, by some of those strange fatalities of history, the strongest of all influences for educational progress was the very one which, during and just after the Reconstruction period, undoubtedly checked the cause. That was the race issue. The movement to eliminate the Negro as a factor in politics involved an appeal to passion, to prejudice, and sometimes a misrepresentation of the part of the colored man in Southern progress. It is fair to say that the Negro carpetbag governments established the public schools of the South. Although recent researchers have shown many germs of a public school system in the South before the war, there can be no reasonable doubt that common school instruction in the South, in the modern sense of the term, was founded by the Freedmen's Bureau and missionary societies, and that the state public school system was formed mainly by Negro Reconstruction governments. Dunning says, "Free public education existed in only a rudimentary and sporadic form in the South before the war, but the new constitutions provided generally for complete systems on advanced Northern models." General Richard P. Hallowell adds, "The whites had always regarded the public school system of the North with contempt. The freedmen introduced and established it, and it stands today a living testimony." From the beginning of the public school system under Reconstruction and after, the fight between local and state control and supervision has been bitter. Local control meant the control of property and racial particularism. It stood for reaction and prejudice. And wherever there was retrogression, particularly in Negro schools, it can be traced to the increased power of the county and district administrators. This accounts for the difficulties, corruption, and failures in Alabama and South Carolina, particularly, and in most of the other southern states. For the first success of the Negro schools, the South deserved little praise. From the beginning, most of the southern states made the Negro schools just as bad as they dared to in the face of national public opinion, and every cent spent on them was taken from Negro rents and wages and came back to the property holders tenfold in increased opportunities for exploitation. It is said, for instance, in one state, there were to be free public schools. The blacks were to be the chief beneficiaries of the new system, but the whites would pay the taxes. Whites considered such education either useless or positively dangerous to society. Of free, self-sacrificing gifts for the sake of Negro uplift and intelligence, the vast majority of Southern white people contributed almost nothing. In recent years, under the influence of educational leaders like Atticus Haygood and James Dillard, the support of Negro education in some Southern states has become more enlightened and generous. This is particularly true in North Carolina, West Virginia, and Texas. Improvement over unusually bad conditions may be noted also in Louisiana, Virginia, and Delaware. The situation in South Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi is still reactionary and deplorable, while the improvement in Arkansas, Tennessee, and Kentucky is not great. Finally, the movement that saved the Negro public school system was not enlightened Southern opinion, but rather that Northern philanthropy, which at the very beginning of the Negro education movement contributed toward the establishment of Negro colleges. The reason for them at first was to supply the growing demand for teachers and was also a concession to Southern prejudice, which so violently disliked the white teacher in the Negro school. This led to the establishment, by 1879, of 84 normal and high schools and 16 colleges, with over 12,000 students. But these institutions soon saw a higher mission. In the midst of reaction and disfranchisement, of poverty and growing caste, they became the centers of a training in leadership and ideals for the whole Negro race, and the only fine and natural field of contact between white and black culture. The fathers of 40 years ago anticipated the criticisms of later years as to the wisdom of colleges for the development of a backward race. So, they said, let it be granted that other lines of education are imperative. Colleges also certainly are needed, and we must set the standards for the education of the race now. Thorough training, large knowledge, and the best culture possible are needed to invigorate, direct, purify, and broaden life. Needed for the wise administration of citizenship, the duties of which are as sure to come as the sun is to shine, though today or tomorrow may be cloudy. Needed to overcome narrowness, one-sidedness, and incompleteness. Howard University and Freedmen's Hospital are survivals of the Freedmen's Bureau. Howard University was chartered in 1867, and General O.O. Howard, head of the Freedmen's Bureau, was made its first president. Succeeding as presidents were W.W. Patton, J.E. Rankin, who wrote, God be with you until we meet again, and John Gordon, a lineal descendant of Jonathan Edwards. On its governing board have been Douglas, Langston, and Bruce. And it has the largest Negro medical center in the United States and has furnished about half of the Negro lawyers. Berea College was started by John G. Fee, a Kentuckian, who became an abolitionist. After the war, colored students were admitted, and a brother of the president of Oberlin was at the head of the school. For 40 years, colored students attended Berea, but finally, in 1904, the institution was by law closed to Negroes. Hampton Institute was founded by General S. C. Armstrong, near where the Negroes were first made contraband of war, and where a colored woman founded the first colored school. Among its trustees were Mark Hopkins, Phillips Brooks, and John G. Whittier. Atlanta University was founded by Edmund Ware in 1867. To have gone on, as President Ware did, during those early years, there must have been in his heart deathless love and pity for men who needed what he could give them, a faith in the gospel, an eternal righteousness that never wavered, and a love for God that made work easy and suffering joy. Add to this the picture of DeForest at Talladega, Cravath at Fisk, and others at Biddle, Knoxville, New Orleans, and Central Tennessee. There are those two influential schools at the edge of the South, Lincoln in Pennsylvania and Wilberforce in Ohio. Nearly all of these educational leaders were either nominated by Howard, head of the Freedmen's Bureau, as in the case of General S.C. Armstrong, or received from him the most thoroughgoing operation. There is no greater tribute to the Freedmen's Bureau than this. Propaganda has centered the attention of the world upon these Northerners who took part in the political reconstruction of the South, and particularly upon those who were charged with dishonesty. While of the history of this astonishing movement to plant the New England College in the South and to give the Southern black man a leadership based on scholarship and character, almost nothing has been said. And yet this was the salvation of the South and the Negro. These carpetbaggers deserve to be remembered and honored. Without them, there can be no doubt that the Negro would have rushed into revolt and vengeance and played into the hands of those determined to crush him. As it was, when reaction triumphed in 1876, there was already present a little group of trained leadership which grew by leaps and bounds until it gripped and held the mass of Negroes at the beginning of the 20th century. Had it not been for the Negro school and college, the Negro would, to all intents and purposes, have been driven back to slavery. His economic foothold in land and capital was too slight in 10 years of turmoil to affect any defense or stability. His Reconstruction leadership had come from Negroes educated in the North and white politicians, capitalists, and philanthropic teachers. The counter-revolution of 1876 drove most of these, save the teachers, away. But already, through establishing public schools and private colleges, and by organizing the Negro Church, the Negro had acquired enough leadership and knowledge to thwart the worst designs of the new slave drivers. They avoided the mistake of trying to meet force by force. They bent to the storm of beating, lynching, and murder, and kept their souls, in spite of public and private insult of every description. They built an inner culture, which the world recognizes in spite of the fact that it is still half-strangled and inarticulate. There is wide, wide wonder in it all, that from degraded rest and servile toil, the fiery spirit of the seer should call these simple children of the sun and soil. Oh, black slave singers, gone, forgot, unfamed, you alone of all the long, long line of those who've sung untaught, unknown, unnamed, have stretched up upward, seeking the divine. James Weldon Johnson.